The future of affordable housing, Florida's growing Hispanic vote, and 50 years protecting the Everglades. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Switalski, in for Luis Hernandez today. There's a bill in Tallahassee that could prevent cities from requiring affordable housing development. City Commissioner Ken Russell explains his concerns as the city is developing a housing master plan. Plus, the 2020 presidential election is picking up steam. One voting demographic could play a key role. We'll have a panel discussion today about Florida's Hispanic vote and what each party is doing to get their base energized. Finally, a South Florida nonprofit has spent 50 years protecting the world's river of grass. How one woman from Friends of the Everglades is still keeping activist Marjorie Stoneman Douglas's mission alive. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome back to Sundial. I'm Katie Switalski, guest hosting for Luis Hernandez. If you've been living in South Florida for long enough, you know how expensive housing is here. The lack of available affordable housing here has been a point of focus for politicians and researchers. Last year, the city of Miami passed an inclusionary zoning measure for the Omni housing development downtown. It would require a portion of the apartments in those developments to be made affordable. The city's also launched an affordable housing master plan and has been seeking input from residents. But lawmakers in Tallahassee have different ideas in mind. New legislation moving forward would prevent cities from requiring that affordable housing is part of new developments. Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell spearheaded the Omni Inclusionary Zoning Project and is following the bill in Tallahassee closely. He joins us now in studio. Welcome, Commissioner Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And later on, he'll update us on plans for the Coconut Grove Playhouse and explain why you've been seeing so many electric scooters downtown. Commissioner, let's start first with what's your understanding of the legislation that's currently in Tallahassee? How are the commissioners expecting it to impact the city of Miami's ability to create affordable housing zones?
Well, it's very fluid. It's happening as we speak in Tallahassee right now. They're in the last days of session, and this is one of the issues they're taking up. Both the Senate and the House have different versions of this, but both tend to want to preempt a local government's ability to address this housing issue on a mandatory basis.
And, you know, can you explain a little bit what the Omni housing development that you spearheaded last year was and how it's going to work?
Sure. So the city has purview to make changes to our zoning code. And the elected officials in the city, the commissioners, are able to do that. What's never been done before in the history of Miami or the state is mandatory inclusionary affordability. And the concept is that we give significant entitlements to development, and in exchange, they give a certain portion of workforce or affordable housing within that development. And it's a partnership. What the state is concerned is they feel there's a mandate coming down, and there have been bad examples of inclusionary zoning around the country. But I studied this legislation throughout different examples, and we found what works and what doesn't. And what we've done here in Miami is what's working. So we're hoping that the good intentions of Tallahassee don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
And so if you could define for me, what is affordable housing in this case? What's the percentage of income that people would be paying that makes these apartments affordable in these zones?
Sure. This is at the higher end of affordability, which is called workforce housing. And so these are young professionals, the workforce of the community. This is not the extremely low income, but it could be. Inclusionary zoning could reach into any one of those levels of the spectrum of affordable housing. In this case, we are targeting the core of downtown, where it's very hard for a young professional to find any place to live that's within their price bracket. So they end up having to live far outside of town and commute and add to our whole traffic problem. So the idea that you could live in the core where you work is a big plus to quality of life, traffic, you name it. And so that's the concept. We're looking at, in this case, up to 140% of AMI, which is the average median income. And so you're going to have apartments just over $1,000 in an area where they could be nearly $2,000. And so that is affordable relative to what's there now, but it's nowhere. It's just scratching the surface of what we need to do for the city as a whole. So for us to have just put our foot in the door on a concept and to see that we might lose that potential path is troubling.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the master plan that the city's been developing. You actually met with residents last month. What were the focus of those discussions? What ideas came out of that? Did it relate to some of this affordability and percentage?
Absolutely. And no matter how much we do, what we learn is we're not doing enough, because affordability is such a crisis in the city of Miami. We are actually one of the first things we learned out of this study, which is being put together by the Metropolitan Center at FIU, is that city of Miami is number one in being the absolute worst city in the country when it comes to how much of people's income is spent on their housing. And so we have nearly 70% of our residents paying over 30% of their income on their housing. And the next number two city is, well, 10% below us. So, we are an anomaly. We are an outlier on this situation, and we have a crisis. So everyone's concerned. The residents are coming at this not only from rental, but from ownership, from a perspective of those just coming out of homelessness and getting their first key, to those who have a college degree but can't live in town.
And we actually did speak with a researcher on WLRN Sundial recently about, you know, this exact issue that you're talking about. And I'm curious, sort of going back to what's going on in Tallahassee, you know, how do you respond to the argument that establishing a cost ceiling for housing development will ultimately reduce incentives for development in available housing units?
If done in a vacuum, that could be a negative consequence. If you just try to get the world of development to solve your housing crisis, it's not going to happen. If you leave it to them voluntarily, they're not going to do it. You've got your traditional housing developers that play in that game, and they know how to get the federal incentives that are out there. We're trying to think outside the box and use the municipal tools to bring otherwise market rate developers into this world of affordability. Now, they may do it kicking and screaming at first, but once they recognize the incentive package we're putting together and that the end product actually organically works for them, that they can get financing, that people do rent out, and that's what's happening in this area where we've done the inclusionary zoning, it's a complete success. And we've got new developers that are getting involved, and they're having success. So it works.
Well, for the developer that's concerned, can I make money if I'm offering an apartment at an affordable rate to an area? What are some of these incentives?
So when a developer buys land in the city of Miami, they land bank it, and they either try to wait for the market to be right, or they seek an entitlement or an upzoning that'll give them additional capacity or density. In some parts of the city, that's okay. We have the capacity and the space. They're on public transit. It's in the core of the city, and we have the room. Now, the particular area that we rezoned for this, it's called T624, and that's a technical term. You called it the Omni area, which is accurate. This is the area of downtown that's west of the Arsht Center, east of Overtown, and just north of I-395. So there's a whole area of blighted land that's undeveloped, and people have been sitting on for years and not pulling the trigger on.
It's right next to the studios we're sitting in.
We are actually in this area, and there's three new towers that have come up in this area that are using this zoning code already successfully. And so the ceiling, the incentive is basically the additional zoning intensity that they received to be able to build additional floors, so that financially they're not subsidizing the affordability. They're getting an incentive package that the affordability is a small ask to make out of that.
Oh, I'm curious, have you been able to have these conversations about your concerns with the bill, with the bill's sponsor, Jacksonville Republican Jason Fisher, you know, and been able to express these to him?
So I've been reaching out to allies in Tallahassee. This isn't just an argument about preemption. There are many issues where the cities all throughout the state have an issue where we don't feel that the state should be weighing in on some of the local rules. And some of those we may never have success on, but we're seeing a lot of those when it comes to plastic bans.
Plastic straws.
We're preempted from living wage, changing the minimum wage. There's a lot of things like that. But in this particular case, where it's actually within our purview to change the zoning of the city, if we do it in a well-thought-out way, it can be very positive. And so their fear is of the negative consequence of doing it wrong, but what we'd like to show them, there's already a positive example of this happening. So let's hit the brakes and let's work on this together for next session. Because if there are types of mandates that you don't want to see that make sense, I'd even support that. But to say let's throw all mandates out the door, if left to its own devices completely voluntarily, the market rate world will displace this community completely.
Well, you mentioned plastic straw bans. Do you think that this is a move by Tallahassee to usurp local control over controversial issues like housing and the environment? I mean, is this a total trying to move power, in your opinion?
I don't see it that way. I see a good intention where Tallahassee sees or hears from one side of an argument and feels they need to fix the problem. It's up to us to show them the other side of the argument in how well thought out the local government is doing this, to make sure they don't try to intercede. That's the goal.
Well, I'm speaking with Miami City Commissioner Ken Russell, representing District 2. Russell spearheaded a plan last year to establish an affordable housing development and has been a key part of the city's master plan. It comes as lawmakers in Tallahassee push forward a bill that would prevent cities from doing just that. Commissioner, I want to transition now from housing development to a different type of building. You're all too familiar with the controversy facing the future of the Coconut Grove Playhouse. A special emergency City of Miami Commission meeting is set for next week to discuss the future plans for the building. Briefly remind us, what's the county's proposed plan? They want to demolish a portion of the building and renovate the other part, right?
Sure. And historic preservation is a little further down the list than housing in terms of a crisis within the city. But from a cultural perspective, historic preservation perspective, this playhouse issue has brought more drama to the City of Miami than you'd have ever seen on that stage. People are very, very passionate about this issue in Coconut Grove. And if you're familiar with it, at the corner of Main Highway and historic Charles Avenue in the West Grove stands the Coconut Grove Playhouse. It's currently blue. It used to be sort of a sienna color when it was built almost 100 years ago. Has a very dramatic facade with a lot of fenestration. It's very beautiful, but it's been left unattended for a long time, many years, and it's really in bad shape. The state owns it. It's been leased to the county, and the county has developed a plan to redevelop it. Now, there are two sides to this argument in this preservation world. My role in this as a city commissioner, this is being brought to me in a quasi-judicial fashion. There's a lot of things that I can work on just purely political and what I believe, but in this particular case, I have to stick to the facts of what's being presented in this appeal, and it's the county appealing the decision of the Miami's Historic Board, which said, of your plan, they don't approve of certain parts of the plan, which include demolition of the actual theater structure itself.
And just for our listeners, you know, there is one camp of people on this issue that want the entire playhouse preserved. And then the county's plan, it would include partial restoration, but partial demolition and rebuilding, including a parking garage. I'm curious, do we know what the estimated cost and timeline of the project would be if it does get approved?
Either plan is in the tens of millions of dollars. The full preservation idea would cost more, probably. But honestly, even though there's two plans out there, my job in this role is to simply weigh in on what the county has presented and decide, along with my fellow commissioners, whether or not it meets historic standards for the City of Miami and the designation there. And it's also on the National Register of Historic Sites. But the important thing to note here, because there's a lot of confusion out there, and there's even been polls run that say nearly everybody, you know, wants the restoration or the county plan. What everybody wants is to see theater come back. And there's a common thread therein. Everyone wants us to do something. People are tired of seeing it sit there rotting away when it's such an iconic and historic building to the Grove. But for either side to not recognize that the other side has valid points and a plan that is possibly viable is irresponsible. I really think there are, I'm running for re-election and knocking on thousands of doors, and I'm telling you, this community is very split over these plans.
I'm curious, how do you respond to criticism from some Coconut Grove residents that the county has not adequately considered other options, like renovating the entire building?
They say that they have and that it's not viable. So what you get into is a battle of the experts as to whether the building can be brought back, what the appropriate way is. But what we need to find is where we agree. One is to bring it back in some sense or another. There's total agreement in that. We don't want to see it turn into a mall or be sold off for development or whatever. Everyone agrees that the entire front building should be saved. Everyone agrees that the garage should happen. The Coconut Grove business area, the restaurants, the shops, they need parking so badly. This garage, you know, is a crucial part of the plan. The only place they disagree on is whether or not to demolish or preserve the shell of the theater.
And I'm just going to remind our listeners that the special Miami City Commission meeting is set for next week. It's on Wednesday, May 8th at Miami City Hall. We'll have more details if people want to attend on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I want to move over to one last story with you, Commissioner. Folks who've driven through downtown Miami have seen them all over. The electric rental scooters are back. The pilot program was launched last fall, but folks haven't seen the scooters in full swing until the start of April. Can we remind folks about the controversy that the scooters initially faced? And they were here, and then they weren't, and now they're back.
Sure. You're hitting all my favorites: historic preservation, housing, and transit. So scooters are actually, I mean, we've seen them now in District 2 only. So if you're a City of Miami resident, you've only seen them in District 2 because it's been an approved pilot program in the district that I serve. And basically, six companies have come forward. Each of them have paid a $50,000 licensing fee to the City of Miami to start the program. And they're also paying a fee per day per scooter on the road. And then we've regulated them very heavily in unique ways that have never been done anywhere else in the country to really ensure the best quality of life experience, safety experience for everybody. Because these are VC companies, venture capital companies, really more than solving transit, they're out there to really get market share. So if left to their own devices, you'd see a million of these everywhere, and other cities have had nightmares. So far, so good.
Well, I'm curious, how did you determine which companies were able to get into the marketplace, but who, more importantly, who was kept out?
So for me, it's very important that we don't pick winners and losers, especially in an entrepreneurial startup sort of scene. I really want to see what's out there. And we engineered this in a way that the companies with the best app, the best product, and are going to succeed over the others. So the bar we set initially was that $50,000 licensing fee already says you've got to be serious about this. You're not just, you know, buying a couple scooters and throwing them out there. But we also had a lot of technological requirements. They needed to be able to do geofencing so we could see where they were and throughout, and they had to stay in the district. We had to be able to monitor them as a city and do all these things. So that sort of weeded out a few companies as well. The six we ended up with, as the program goes along, the ones that can prove usage every month get to increase their fleet incrementally. Those who have poor usage have to decrease their fleet. And by the end of the program, the best companies and best product will win out, I'd say.
My last question for you on this is safety. I think a lot of people see these scooters, they go pretty fast, and they see scooters, cars, and a lot of people wonder, where does the liability fall if and when there's an accident?
Sure. We have a very strong indemnity program with the scooter companies. But safety is a major concern. I've worked together with the police chief on this, with the Miami Parking Authority, with our city administration to make sure that we're doing everything we can to make this a safe rollout. And thank God there's not been any major incidents so far.
But that liability falls on the user of
so,
the scooter?
Yes. So it's on the user and it's on the scooter company. The city of Miami is not liable for someone who this is you want to treat this the same way as you would a cyclist. They're out there on their own accord. If something's wrong with the product or something and they get hurt, there's an issue there. But they're allowed to be in the bike lanes. They're allowed to carefully be on the sidewalks, and we have them regulated for speed. So hopefully everyone stays safe and wears a helmet.
Thank you for joining us, Commissioner.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for covering it.
I've been speaking with City Commissioner Ken Russell, representing District 2 in Miami, and you can find more info about these electric scooters, the Coconut Grove Playhouse, and affordable housing in the 305 by going to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Still to come, there's new research on the growing Hispanic vote in Florida. We've got a panel discussion on the role it could play in the 2020 elections. Welcome back to Sundial. I'm Katie Spitalski. As candidates gear up for the upcoming 2020 presidential elections, a question that's gathered much attention is how will candidates engage with the fastest growing population in the U.S., Latinos? Hispanics are the fastest growing portion of Florida's eligible voting population heading into the 2020 election. It grew 81% from the 2014 elections up to 2018, and people who registered to vote grew over 100%. That's according to recent data all gathered by Univision. Fernand Amandi is a Democratic pollster here in Miami and host of the podcast Strange Days with Fernand Amandi. And Bruno Barrero is the state committeeman for the Republican Party of Florida representing Miami-Dade County. They join us in studio to talk about how each party is preparing for the upcoming election. Thank you both for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So before we get into the questions, I want to define what we mean when we talk about Latino and Hispanic, because we'll be using both terms during the interview. Latino is referring to a person of Latin American descent in the U.S., while Hispanic refers to the group of people who share the same common language, Spanish. So, Fernand, we'll start with you. In a state like Florida with an immense Hispanic population, what's the Democratic Party doing to win this vote?
Not enough, unfortunately. And that's been proven out by the election results we've seen. I don't think anyone disputes that in November of 2018, the last midterm election that just happened, there was an extraordinary blue wave across the country. And part of the reason why the Democrats were so successful in not only recapturing the Congress, but winning an extraordinary historic number of seats was because of strong Hispanic support across the country. That did not translate to the Sunshine State of Florida, simply because the Republicans really outworked and outflanked the Democrats when it came to the Hispanic vote, in particular the Puerto Rican vote that is in Central Florida, which is an emerging vote that's really what's driving and moving forward the explosive Hispanic growth, and then going back to consolidating their base vote, which were the older Cuban American voters. Democrats had made inroads with that community of Cuban Hispanic voters in 2008 and in 2012 and even in 2016, but it reverted back to the mean, and it was because the Republicans just did a better job, frankly.
Well, Bruno, what is the Republican Party in Florida doing now to win over Hispanic voters? What have you been seeing that works and what doesn't work?
I think we continue to do what we have set out to be do for the entire state. Make sure that there's a strong economy, that there's jobs, that there's a security in our state, that we are attractive to the populations to live here, not only to visit as a tourist, but to be a good quality of life location. And that's just good common policy at the state level and at the local governments. And I think that's why people responded in 2016 to the federal government message of the administration, that they were going to bring back, make sure there was focus on the economy for this country, not the entire globe. Obviously, we want to be great neighbors to our the rest of the world. We want to help it where we can, but we got to make sure that our house is taken care of. And that message, I think, resonated to the Hispanics. The Hispanics have, unfortunately, for whatever reason, for different reasons, have come to this country looking for stability in jobs, for their families. And that's what we offer. And as a Republican Party, to make sure that there's stability, that people can look forward to tomorrow, make sure that their jobs are there, that we are more jobs are there for their children. And I think that's, at the end of the day, what people have been looking at. Obviously, here in South Florida, we have the issue with Venezuela, with Cuba, making sure that we are not pandering to these dictators. And I think the Republican Party has sent that message out.
So, Bruno, you recently left your post as Miami-Dade commissioner to run for Congress. What was your strategy for targeting the Hispanic population in South Florida?
I went out straight to the voters, knocked on their doors, got their message, heard from them, opened our arms to them, and basically, I think that's what works. If people want to see a candidate that they could talk to, know that the kind of candidate is hearing their message, and responds, and that just doesn't give them a quasi lukewarm answer, or, gives them their straight out position.
In the past 2018 midterm election, Florida Republicans won two major races, Senate and governor. But this is despite the influx of Puerto Ricans that came from the island after Hurricane Maria, like you were talking about, Fernand, and the growing Central American population. Why do you think Democratic messaging came up short during the midterms?
Well, Woody Allen, I think, said it best. He said that the secret to life was 90% just showing up. And unfortunately, from the Democratic perspective in that case, the Republican Party just did a much better job physically showing up, engaging the community, the campaigns of Rick Scott, the campaigns of Ron DeSantis, who actually named a Hispanic as his lieutenant governor. Rick Scott started doing Spanish language outreach and engagement years, literally years before the election, and that was sustained all the way through. I look at this from a numbers-based perspective, and with all due respect to Commissioner Barrero, who has always defended his party's interests well, on every single issue, Hispanic voters in Florida, including, I might add, Cuban Americans who cite themselves as conservative, on the issues they side with the Democratic Party, whether it's health care, whether it's how public education should be administered, whether it's the handling and the stewardship of the economy, even on foreign policy matters, there is a consensus position towards the Democrats. The problem, though, is if the Democrats don't show up and don't do the type of sustained, engaged campaigning that the Republicans do, they're going to not get and maximize that vote.
So was 2018 more about the candidates, not about the issues then in your perspective?
From my perspective, in going after and in targeting those votes, the Republicans recognized early on they were never going to win the Hispanic vote in Florida. That's never going to happen again. But what they can do is manage the margins. So in other words, they said, look, we can't lose by 50 points with the Hispanic vote. But if we lose by 35 points instead of 50, that extra 15% that we go after and win might be the difference. Guess what happened? Rick Scott won barely by the skin of his teeth. I think it was less than 15,000 votes over the incumbent Bill Nelson. Andrew Gillum barely loses by about 35,000 votes to Ron DeSantis. Had they performed at the levels of the Hispanic vote that Barack Obama got in Florida in 2012, Andrew Gillum would be governor and Bill Nelson would still be in the Senate.
Well, numbers gathered by Univision show that simply translating campaign messaging to Spanish starting early on reaches more potential voters sooner. Have both parties been doing this? We'll start with you, Bruno.
Yeah, we continue to outreach, to get our message out. We've done extensive media outreach at the regular quarterly meetings of the Republican Party. We have press conferences and we send out information on our policies, on our positions. So I think we continue to do that, and we will continue to do that. It's a fact of life. The Hispanic population in this country, and obviously in the state of Florida, will continue to grow. I think the stats were by 2034, 2040, there would be, I think, a substantial amount of people speaking Spanish primarily. So I think we have to basically, we have to address it. We cannot turn a blind eye on it. And I think we have been in the sense of outreach.
And Fernand, I mean, how effective has this been? Are Democrats doing the same thing?
Well, let's use an example that I think Commissioner Barrero would appreciate and understand. We saw a contested congressional race down here in Florida that was held by a Republican. It was at Leona Ross Layton, in a Republican seat for over 25 years. You had a Cuban-American woman Republican candidate in Maria Elvira Salazar, who was able to defeat the incumbent commissioner in the primary. Mm-hmm. She went up against a non-Cuban in Donna Shalala. But Donna Shalala, who was the Democratic candidate running again against a Cuban-American Hispanic woman, was able to defeat her by engaging the Hispanic community and reminding them where her party and where she stood on the issues. So yes, when the Democrats compete with Republicans for the Hispanic vote, they will be successful every time because, as I said earlier, from a numbers perspective, they are philosophically aligned with them on the issues. The problem is the Democrats have done a very poor job across the state of Florida in doing that base Woody Allen philosophy of just showing up in some cases.
But I think also the Republicans can't just say we're going to concentrate on the Hispanics and forget about the rest of the population. Our message is across the board. Same message across the board to the entire population, all the voters. And I think in that sense, unfortunately, in that district, since I didn't have the opportunity to be in the general, but that was the fault. They were concentrating strictly on just the Hispanics. And that you can't do. You have to have crossover votes across all communities. This is one community at the end of the day.
And I do want to mention, so Governor Ron DeSantis ordered Spanish language ballots to be provided across Florida for the 2020 election. I'm curious, Bruno, we'll start with you. What ways has this projected to change voting behavior in Florida, the requirement of Spanish language ballots?
I think it'll help. It definitely gives more opportunities for people to be informed and be comfortable in turning out to vote. I think you're going to get, unfortunately, as though it's more or less the same voter turnout. So you increase it a little bit, and we do all our effort, and we get out mailers, and we get out. But, you know, there's unfortunately a complacency in the electorate. It happens in the Democrats and the Independents and the Republicans. No matter how much mail you got, it's tough to get them out. And but we do. We spend as much as we can, and we outreach as much as we can, and we knock on with the technology we have in today's world. We know exactly how many doors we knocked, how many houses we reached. And it's very difficult.
And so, Fernando, I'll ask you, I mean, in what ways do you think that requiring Spanish language ballots in Florida is going to change voting behavior, if at all?
Well, from the perspective of making Spanish dominant voters who actually turn out and vote, it's going to make it obviously easier for them. It limits the barriers to access. And I think you'll probably see greater participation in all the ballots. And so many of us know that in some of these cases, especially in November general election, the ballot sometimes is 5-6 pages long. There's 25 questions. If it's a Spanish language ballot across the state, particularly for those that don't speak English and have now the opportunity, I think you may see them complete the entire ballot as opposed to just voting for president or a couple of other key offices and then leaving the lengthy paragraph style questions for later. But look, I think fundamentally we saw massive historic record turnout by Hispanic voters in this last midterm election. You are going to see that repeated. If you don't believe me, bring me back. I'm saying it now. I'm making the prophecy that you're going to see record Hispanic turnout in the November 2020 presidential election. I think that's going to be duplicated all across the United States. Turnout is not going to be the problem. So in this case, Ron DeSantis, I think, understands the trend. He's trying to get ahead of things. And it's interesting because he's almost acting outside of the purview of his own Republican Party, which is not so friendly when it comes to those dual language approaches to things.
I'm speaking with Fernand Amandi, a Democratic pollster here in Miami and host of the podcast Strange Days with Fernand Amandi. And Bruno Barrero, he's the state committeeman for the Republican Party of Florida representing Miami-Dade County. We're talking about how both parties are preparing to attract the Hispanic vote ahead of 2020. Bruno, I want to ask, you know, at the beginning of the conversation, we defined the terms Hispanic and Latino. What's the importance of differentiating both groups of people and acknowledging the differences among all ethnicities when targeting that sector of the population?
I think the issue is they're Hispanics, and the issue is the language. But at the end, at the end, they are all majority immigrants that came into this country looking for a better life for themselves, for their children, for their families. And I would say one thing that we were talking about, the parties, while the Democrats and the Republicans are trying to vie for these people, we're having a very difficult time. The majority of people are registering as independents. And that's the big thing that no one wants to talk about. And what's happening there? Why are people not choosing one of the two parties? And the biggest block is the no party affiliation. And we got to continue to get our message across, explain to people why we have their core values, and why we address them, and the common thing that we all live together in one state with the same rules that apply to everybody.
And so, Fernand, I'm going to ask you, voter turnout for Latinos has been in flux over the years. According to the Pew Research Center, Latino voter turnout has dropped more than 10% from the late 80s up to 2014. The 2018 numbers are still being gathered, but it, you know, preliminary reports show that it did increase in 2018. Why do you think that voter turnout's decreased if the Latino population has been growing in the U.S.?
Well, actually, I think they're increasing based on what we just saw in 2018. I think you're going to see them increase again. And I think the reason why is Hispanics in this country feel that they are under assault, literally, and in fact, they are, by the president of the United States, Donald Trump, and the Republican Party. It's not just Trump by himself. It's the party as a whole has basically declared war, so to speak, ideologically, when it comes to the Hispanic community. They don't value the contributions of Hispanics to the United States. There is a push that we see manifest in their immigration policies, where they're saying in no uncertain terms, the cultivation of white supremacist rhetoric that we see taking place around the country. So in many respects, I think you're seeing increased turnout and increased participation by Hispanic voters, not just in Florida, mind you, but across the country, because it becomes a question of survival, particularly as their fate could very well be on the ballot in 2020.
Is under no circumstance the case.
I've got one more question for you, Bruno. Along those lines, coming up in the 2020 presidential election, do you feel like President Trump's rhetoric towards Latinos will be a problem when, you know, trying to get support for the Republican Party?
Look, our administration, the Trump administration, loves the Latino and Hispanic voters. If anything, we've helped them more through our policies to get jobs, to improve their quality of life.
But rhetoric we don't want
them to be cheap, the sheep of the party. We want them to be part of the party and be part of the influencers. If you see here in the state of Florida, you're seeing Latinos getting elected not only in South Florida, not only in Orlando, but across the entire state as Republicans in Titusville, in a bunch of other state representatives. And I think you're going to see that throughout the country. Our party reaches out and is inclusive of everybody. We don't want them to turn out just for the vote and forget about them the next 4 years.
Well, thank you. I've been speaking with Fernand Amandi, a Democratic pollster here in Miami and host of the podcast Strange Days with Fernand Amandi, and Bruno Barrero. He's the state committeeman for the Republican Party of Florida representing Miami-Dade County. Thank you both for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
And still to come, they've been fighting for 50 years to protect the Everglades. We'll hear from a woman with Friends of the Everglades. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Katie Swatulski, in for Luis Hernandez today. An organization that pushes to protect, preserve, and restore the Everglades just celebrated 50 years of advocacy. Friends of the Everglades was started by the famous writer and South Florida nature advocate herself, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Connie Washburn sits on the board of directors for the nonprofit. I got to talk with her this week about what 50 years of fighting for the Everglades has been like. What's it looked like in her home in Fort Lauderdale? She moved to Florida from the Midwest, and we started the conversation with her initial impressions of the Everglades.
I thought the Everglades was kind of a boring place to ride through from Miami over to Marco Island, where my parents were living. And so many trips back and forth. And it wasn't until I began teaching about the Everglades that I learned about the Everglades. So I was teaching fourth grade at Howard Drive Elementary, and it's a natural part of the curriculum for fourth graders to study about the Everglades, as it should be. And we learned about the Everglades, and I say we because we learned about it together. And I got hooked on the Everglades.
There was an idea in the 90s to try and build a theme park near the Everglades in Broward County. Your fourth grade class was against it, actually. And that's so interesting to me because it could have been fun for them, but they were already thinking about the environment more than a place to enjoy, like a theme park. How did they express their want to protect the environment?
Oh, we had walkathons, we had tree plantings. We made up slogans like, or they made up slogans like Everglades or Neverglades. We had an acronym that was KEEP, K-E-E-P, Kids Establish Everglades Protection. And that was on the back of a tote bag. But that was really before we got involved with the official group Friends of the Everglades and went to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas for her blessing.
That led to you taking the students to actually meet Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. She was already around 100 or more. What was that visit like?
It was her 105th birthday, and another teacher and I took three students to meet Marjorie and take her a birthday card from Howard Drive Elementary with every student from the school having drawn a little picture or written a little love note to Marjorie. And the students met her and they asked her questions. She was 105. She was very deaf, completely blind, but sharp as a tack. And one of the little girls said to Marjorie, "Thank you, Marjorie, for saving the Everglades." And Marjorie said, "Oh, no, my dear. The Everglades are not saved yet, and it is up to your generation to save it." And that really started Young Friends of the Everglades.
What was your impression of Marjorie?
She was a no-nonsense person, very sharp, extremely knowledgeable about the Everglades, and she was self-educated as well, and then, of course, wrote Everglades River of Grass. But she came from up north, as well as I came from the Midwest, and she had to learn about the Everglades, everything about it, the science, the politics, how it works. And once she did that, then she set out to protect the Everglades.
Did that inspire you a little bit, that you have something in common with her, that you both had to learn about this place? It wasn't something you grew up around or something intrinsic?
Because South Florida is so transient, many people live here and have no clue about the Everglades, just like I did, and actually Marjorie did. And the reason that she learned about the Everglades is she was asked to write a book about a river. So that is how the Everglades got the term River of Grass. That is, she realized that the Everglades flows out of Lake Okeechobee through the wetlands and flows south to Florida Bay, and it is a very shallow, slow-moving river. She became upset when people started building dams and canals and taking crooked rivers and making them straight, all the unnatural things that people try to do to the Everglades, as well as building on the Everglades.
You've been a part of the organization for 25 years, half of its life. This year, the group is celebrating its 50th anniversary. So what is the greatest accomplishment for the group been in that time that you've been with them? What have you seen?
I think our greatest accomplishment is, one, the fact that there are many, many, many environmental groups. In fact, somebody said to me, there are so many environmental groups. What makes Friends of the Everglades different? And what makes us different is our mission is to preserve, protect, and restore the only Everglades in the world. And we concentrate on that. So issues like drilling in the Everglades, the nutrient level, the water quality and where the water goes, the flow out of Lake Okeechobee, the algal blooms, the deterioration of the bay as a result of all these nutrients getting into the bay, both seagrasses and the coral reefs. We focus on those issues, and we're trying to build a membership so that we have a large membership to express the will of the people. And this is the will of the people. People voted for clean water. People voted to send the water south. People voted no offshore oil drilling.
I'm speaking with Connie Washburn in Fort Lauderdale. She sits on the board of directors for the advocacy group, Friends of the Everglades. The nonprofit just celebrated 50 years of education to protect, preserve, and restore the Everglades. You can find even more info about the 50 years of Everglades history on our social media at WLRN Sundial. When you start talking about these nutrients and climate change and all of these problems that come with that, when did that become an important part for you in your role at Friends of the Everglades?
Right from the beginning. There is always a battle. And you get one battle either solved or try to get it solved, and something else comes up. Friends of the Everglades and all environmental groups have to be constantly vigilant. And they have to be strong, and they can't compromise. And that's another difference of Friends of the Everglades. We do not compromise, and we are a totally grassroots local organization. We don't have any state organization or national organization. So anybody in the world can be a member and support Friends of the Everglades. And we do have members countrywide and worldwide.
For people asking about how Friends of the Everglades supports the Everglades, is it, you know, through lobbying, through education? What are some of the specific ways that this group can point back to and say, these are our accomplishments in the Everglades?
Well, we are a 501c3, so we cannot lobby. However, our members and donors can lobby by calling their representatives, writing letters to the editor, tweeting, whatever they're doing to get the message out. And so that is really the strength we have had in the past and presently are in litigation. We just honored one of our attorneys who does a lot of pro bono work for Friends of the Everglades in cases to try to mostly hold the government accountable for things that are real laws that need to be fulfilled.
What more do we need to be doing to save the Everglades?
We need to make government officials accountable for the rules. If the rules were followed, we would have a much better chance of protecting the Everglades. Water quality is very important. The amount of water that is allowed to leave Lake Okeechobee and go to both coasts, as you are probably familiar, has been a big problem for several years now, and that needs to be done correctly and scientifically, not according to how special interests want it done.
Well, that leads me to, what do you think about Governor Ron DeSantis' promises that he's made about protecting the Everglades and some of his other promises about algae? Does that seem like it's going in the right direction to Friends of the Everglades or to you, or do you still have concerns?
I am hopefully optimistic, and if all things happen that should happen, and if the wish of the scientists and the people, it's the people's will. You know, the Everglades is 50% the size that it was before development started. And so the building and encroaching keeps going in. There are problems such as Marjorie started with the Everglades with fighting against a jet port. That's how Friends of the Everglades started. A company wanted to build a jet port out in the Big Cypress area. In fact, there are still remains of it. And that is how Friends of the Everglades started when Marjorie said, no, it's not right to build a jet port in the Everglades. And she and Friends of the Everglades and other environmental groups got it stopped. Well, now there is a company that has received permission to drill in the Everglades, have exploratory drilling in the Everglades.
Yeah, in Broward County.
Right. And that is like setting us back 50 years. So it's a constant battle, but we're up for the battle. But we need a large population to support us. And that is part of what we do, is outreach to the public and to children. Friends of the Everglades had a children's environmental outreach program called Young Friends of the Everglades for 20 years, where we went into classrooms and taught a water conservation program to children of Dade County, of Miami-Dade County. And it happened over a period of 20 years. We don't have that grant anymore, but we are working on other forms of outreach to the public.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Connie. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening.
That was Connie Washburn. She's a member of the nonprofit Friends of the Everglades, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. The organization was started by activist Marjorie Stoneman Douglas with a focus on advocacy and education around the River of Grass. You can find pictures of her students with Marjorie Stoneman Douglas and find more of our coverage of the Everglades by going to our Facebook page at WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for this Thursday, May 2nd. I'm Katie Switalski. Thank you so much for listening. Luis Hernandez will be back next week. Let's listen to some more Daughter of the Everglades.